Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Who is the greatest African Premier League player of all time? See if your choice made our list on Match of the Day Africa Top 10, a new podcast from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, 17th of July, these are our main stories. The bridge which connects Russia to occupied Crimea has been closed after explosions. Two people were killed. The Kremlin says a deal allowing Ukraine to export grain through the Black Sea has ended. And thousands of people have been moved from their homes on one of Spain's Canary Islands as emergency services work to contain wildfires. Also in this podcast, a new drug to treat the effects of Alzheimer's has produced positive results, with a decline in mental power slowed down. The Ukrainian military says it carried out the overnight attack on the strategically important Kerch Bridge, linking Russia with occupied Crimea. Moscow also blamed Ukraine, saying the attack killed a civilian couple in a car and injured their daughter. The bridge is considered by Ukrainians as a symbol of Russian occupation in Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014. Our correspondent Paul Adams told me what Ukraine might hope to achieve from this operation.
If you look at it at the map, you'll see that the Kerch Bridge is the only direct link between Russia and Russian-occupied Crimea. Now, obviously, this was something that the Russians took control of back in 2014. And one of the first things that Vladimir Putin did was to commission the construction of a bridge to make sure that the links between Russia and Crimea, which obviously he regarded and many Russians regard as extremely important and historic, were symbolized and cemented by the construction of a bridge. And that was completed in 2018, opened amid great fanfare, and seen as a great triumph of Russia reconnecting with the Crimean Peninsula. Of course, for Ukrainians, it was regarded as, and always has been regarded as, a hated symbol of Russia's illegal annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. And so, from a political point of view, it's always been hugely significant. And then, from a strategic and military point of view, when you look at the supply lines that Russia has to its troops, not just in the Crimean Peninsula, but also just north of the peninsula in occupied southern Ukraine, then you realize just how important that bridge, both the rail and the road links, are. And that's why, not for the first time, we've seen it attacked.
And yet that still leaves the question, why now? I mean, quite a military operation to attack the bridge. Why would they do it at this moment?
I think it was always inevitable that the bridge would be attacked now. You have to see it in the context of Ukraine's counteroffensive, which is aimed at retaking territory in southern Ukraine, captured by Russia early last year. And from that point of view, all of the logistical connections that allow Russian forces to operate in southern Ukraine are extremely important. And the Kerch Bridge is one of those. And we have seen for weeks and weeks now Ukrainian attacks on a variety of targets, all designed to weaken the position of Russian troops in southern Ukraine. And this, I would assume, is just the latest in those attacks.
Paul Adams. Away from the fighting, a huge effort has been made to help Ukraine carry on exporting its grain. And that's not just to keep the country's economy healthy. It's because so many countries around the world rely on Ukrainian wheat and other products. For the past year, a deal has been in place, which meant Russia promised not to attack Ukrainian cargo ships as they sailed through the Black Sea, the main route for exporters. That deal expires at the end of Monday, Turkish time, and Russia, having kept everyone guessing, has now said it will not be renewed. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, did hold out hope that an agreement could be reached in the future.
The Black Sea grain agreement ceased to be valid today. As Vladimir Putin said earlier, it comes to an end on July the 17th. Unfortunately, the part of these Black Sea agreements concerning Russia has not been implemented so far. So, in effect, it's terminated. As soon as the Russian part of the deal is fulfilled, the Russian side will comply immediately.
To explain what's gone wrong, we heard from the BBC's Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, who's in Moscow.
First of all, this isn't a huge surprise because the Kremlin has been dropping very strong hints in recent days that it wasn't really in the mood to renew this this deal. The Russians have been complaining that there are obstacles to the export of Russian grain and Russian fertiliser, and they want those removed. The second thing the Russians have been saying is they want a Russian bank that deals in agricultural payments to be reconnected to the global SWIFT payment network. Now, as far as we can understand, that hasn't been done yet. So Vladimir Putin said the other day in an interview on Russian state television, enough is enough. And that was a hint, a rather strong hint, that Russia wouldn't renew this grain deal. But listening to Dmitry Peskov's comments there, you know, the Russians have left open the possibility that they could return to this deal if some of their complaints are dealt with. And from comments that the Turkish president, President Erdogan, made today, he seems to suggest that the Kremlin could be persuaded to come back. So this isn't the end yet, I think, of the grain deal.
When Russia originally invaded Ukraine, there was soon a spike in food prices worldwide because of just speculation that there might be shortages. Do we have any idea what the effect could be on the cost of food globally now with Russia saying that it will not renew the deal?
Of course, there is a concern, a huge concern about that, because, yes, I mean, the grain deal wasn't only important for Ukraine in helping Ukraine to export grain. It was important in terms of global food prices because they shot up, as you suggested, after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that hit particularly the poorest countries. So, yes, there will be concern. But as I say, I don't think the deal is dead in the water yet. I think there will be diplomatic efforts made in the coming days to get this back on track.
Steve Rosenberg. This is a week in which many expect a few records to be broken, and we're not talking sporting achievements here. Across southern Europe and in the United States, phenomenally high temperatures have been recorded, and they're predicted to get even higher. Europe has seen a hot weather system blow in from North Africa in the past 24 hours. Cities in Italy have been placed under emergency measures, with Greece and Portugal also warning of severe conditions. In the Spanish Canary Islands off the coast of West Africa, residents have been urged to leave their homes as emergency workers tackle a wildfire on the west of the island La Palma. It was witnessed by Sharon Backhouse, the director of a tour company there.
This wildfire is concerning because it's covered such a large area of the northeast of the island. It's about 6.5% of the island. It's about 45 kilometres squared. So it is a substantial size. And they had to evacuate over 4,000 people, particularly from the areas and towns of Punta Gorda and Tijarafe. And these are people, some of them, who had moved to this area particularly to get away from the area to the south of it, which is where the volcano had erupted in 2021. So they're now being disrupted again.
Our reporter Guy Hedgecoe's in Madrid and told us, first of all, the latest on that fire in the Canaries.
Well, Paul, we know that around 500 firefighters are trying to bring it under control at the moment. 4,000 people had been evacuated. Over the last few hours, some of those evacuees have been told they can start returning home. So that is good news there. But it has consumed a huge amount of land and it has destroyed a number of houses as well. The big challenge now for the authorities is to stop this fire from spreading into a nearby national park. I think they're confident they can do that, but it is not yet under control.
And you, of course, are in mainland Spain. Now, many of us will remember the massive destruction from forest fires there last summer. What is the country doing to avoid a repeat of that?
Well, that's right. Last summer was particularly bad for wildfires, and there were fires sort of all over the country throughout the summer. We haven't had that yet. That hasn't been a problem so far, despite the fact we've been seeing these very high temperatures throughout July. But the authorities have been preparing themselves. They say they've been reinforcing local firefighting services. But to a great extent, this depends on local governments. So it really does depend on what each local government does, on its budget, how much it's willing to invest. But I think pretty much all of Spain's 17 regions are bracing themselves for this summer because the conditions are so dry and hot at the moment. They've seen what's happening in the Canary Islands and they're very concerned that that could happen here on the mainland.
And what about those temperatures, quite apart from the threat of fires? I mentioned Italian cities having emergency measures. What's going on in Spain?
Here in central Spain, I'm just outside the capital. We're expecting to see temperatures around 40 degrees later on. The south of Spain in Andalusia is on red alert and could see temperatures up to 44 degrees Celsius later today. We're getting the usual advice we always get from the authorities when there's a heat wave, which is stay out of the heat during the hottest time of day, drink lots of water. High risk groups in particular should be very careful. But there is also a new piece of legislation which has come into force here in Spain, which says that people who work in fields or work outside, manual labourers, if they are in an area which has a high heat alert, then they are not allowed to work during the hottest time of day. And the government hopes that that will prevent a lot of deaths this year.
Guy Hedgeco. Global warming appears to be happening far quicker than climate scientists predicted. People once dismissed as doom-mongers now appear to have understated the urgency of the problem. But the fact remains that it's young people who will eventually feel the worst of the consequences as temperatures and other effects of climate change become increasingly severe towards the end of the century. In the US state of Montana, a group of people between the ages of 5 and 22 have accused the state government of violating their right to a clean and healthy environment, and they're going to court to make their point. Our West Coast correspondent Sophie Long reports.
I was born in a small town and live in a small town.
The small town of Colstrip is celebrating its centenary. 100 years of life built around and entirely dependent on coal. Even the young people here are acutely aware of its value.
I just think they don't get that it really helps us and it gives us power, and if we didn't have coal, we would just be a ghost town.
I think it's going to be fine in the end.
I don't think it has that bad of a change or anything.
Yeah.
But the coal-fueled power plant is one of the biggest producers of CO2 west of the Mississippi. And yet it's in a state where the environment is considered so important. 50 years ago, its cleanliness became a constitutional right. But during the years since, the state has passed some of the most extreme laws preventing people from addressing climate change.
How's the drive?
Amazing, yeah, beautiful.
22-year-old Ricky Held, one of the plaintiffs in this landmark case, lives with her dad on a sprawling ranch down a long dirt road. She says the increase in wildfires, floods and droughts that she's seen in her young life show the laws facilitating the continued use of fossil fuels are violating her rights.
I can feel scared sometimes, kind of when it all sinks in, but also what I want to do is take the steps that we need to, and like for me, being able to testify and be a part of this case is one of those steps that I feel is in the right direction for it. Positive change, because I know that we have to change and I'm hopeful for the future.
The case is being brought by Our Children's Trust, an Oregon-based non-profit that's bringing similar cases in several other states and countries.
I struggle with the whole thing.
Critics, like former coal miner Joe Navasio, say the case is an example of environmental groups using children to push forward their agenda, and that climate change is a global problem that can't be solved in Montana.
We're a pittance of the problem. You can't measure us against the rest of the world. And I know they don't like to hear that, but it's the truth. We aren't less than 0.001% of the total problem with CO2.
Montanas have been torn between the treasures below and above ground for generations. How to benefit from the economic value of what lies beneath while preserving the pristine green pastures and big blue skies above? The next generation will be no different. While young people in Colstrip celebrate their rich history in the shadow of the power plant they're fighting to save, Ricky Held sits on her favourite hilltop, quietly surveying the lush green land she's fighting to protect.
It's my home and I'm worried about it, and just that these changes are already happening. It's not in the future. We can see them and they're already affecting our life here.
The judge's ruling in Montana could set a powerful precedent, but the battle over coal and the climate will continue.
Sophie Long reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
Been through a very difficult ordeal at sea, and I'm just needing rest and good food because I've been alone at sea a long time.
An Australian man survives for 2 months drifting on a damaged sailing boat with his dog.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the new podcast from the BBC World Service discussing all things African football. Join me, Gabriel Zakwani, and two players who know a thing or two about competing on the international stage.
Hi, Yaya Touré here.
And Efan Ekoku.
As we try to choose a winner in our African football top 10s, from the best African defenders to the greatest World Cup moments. That's Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's not just Europe that's seeing high temperatures right now. China has just recorded the highest ever temperature for the month of July, 52 degrees Celsius in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. And the timing of that record being reached is rather pointed, because the US Special Envoy on Climate, John Kerry, has just arrived in Beijing to discuss how to tackle global warming. On the one hand, China has promised that its emissions will reach a peak in 2026 and that it will be carbon neutral by 2060. But critics say this is too slow, and that in any case, China's current behaviour suggests its emissions will continue to rise. It's only just announced a new programme of building coal-fired power stations. Our reporter in Hong Kong, Martin Yip, told me nobody was expecting any kind of breakthrough in cooperation.
We had 4 hours of talks between these two key figures in the US and China about climate change, John Kerry and Xie Zhenhua. But this very inevitable that the two countries, even if we just talk about climate change, have quite a lot of differences between each other on how the use of coal should be put to an end, cut down of methane emissions, because China still relies on many of these coal power plants to give power to the country, to boost the country's economy. And so even when China is praised for all its developments in the renewable energy aspect, like wind energy, electric cars and all that, there are just differences between the two countries, where, especially when China thinks it has the legitimacy to develop its economy.
That's crucial, isn't it? This insistence that other countries can't just tell China to stop. That sense they have that other countries have caused the CO2 emissions they should be allowed to develop.
They need the power to boost the country. Renewable energy is catching up, but it's still not enough to replace everything in China, obviously. So China is still taking down this path of great rejuvenation of Chinese race under the leadership of President Xi Jinping. So you can see the kind of resistance that Washington would face when trying to convince China to drop these fossil fuels in daily life and in daily production.
Talks between China and the US on climate change had broken down. That was because China objected to Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi visiting Taiwan. Do you get the impression that that's all in the past, or are the tensions between the two countries still a problem in getting them to talk about climate change?
If you bring in this wider political spectrum, that obviously is nowhere close from Beijing saying they have put everything behind, because obviously the US is still expressing its support to Taiwan, to President Tsai Ing-wen's government in Taipei, and this is something that Beijing has no way for President Xi Jinping to agree on. So in China's point of view, it's quite hard for them to push something very meaningful forward. I'm not saying there will be no progress at all, but China has made it clear for many times on many occasions, even since the most recent visit by Secretary Blinken to China, that Taiwan remains a crucial problem in the US-China relations.
Martin Yip. At least 9 people have been shot dead in northwest Cameroon in an attack blamed on separatist rebels. Among the victims were a newly wed couple. 5 other people were seriously injured. According to eyewitnesses, the gunmen arrived at a busy junction in the city of Bamenda. Will Ross reports.
These latest killings appear to be yet another example of the separatist rebels punishing people they accuse of siding with the Cameroonian army. Less than a week ago, in the same area of the city of Bamenda, soldiers carried out a raid, killing five young men. According to eyewitnesses, when the gunmen arrived this time, they ordered people to lie on the ground. They then opened fire as some of them tried to flee in panic. Human rights groups say both the rebels and the army have carried out frequent abuses against civilians who are stuck between the two sides.
Will Ross. Now, forgive me if you feel like you've heard this before, but scientists are positively crowing about the test results from a new drug to treat dementia. There have been plenty of false dawns in the past, medicines hailed as a breakthrough which ultimately came to nothing. But the drug donanemab really is making waves. Initial results suggested it could slow down the decline of brain power by a third. And this achievement now looks like it'll be confirmed later today when final test results are published. Britain's Alzheimer's Society said this would mean we were in a new era for dementia treatment. Our medical editor, Fergus Walsh, explained how the new drug works.
It's an infusion given once a month into the arm, and it clears a rogue protein from the brain called amyloid. Amyloid sticks in clumps around neurons, these sticky deposits called plaques. And so it clears amyloid, allowing those cells to communicate, and so preventing slowing decline. Now, we don't have the results. They're coming out in a few hours' time in Amsterdam and, crucially, in a peer-reviewed medical journal. But if they repeat the top-line results that were published in May, it would mean that the drug slows cognitive decline by about a third over 18 months in patients with early Alzheimer's. So it does not, it is not a miracle cure. It does not halt cognitive decline. But in a field where we've had a real desert in terms of new drugs, it would be the second new drug in the space of a year working on the same principles that actually deal with the underlying mechanism of Alzheimer's.
You've made it clear, not a cure, slows down the decline. I guess people will want to know, are we anywhere near getting something that really would stop Alzheimer's in its track, treat other kinds of dementia?
We're not there yet, but I've been covering this field for a long time and it's just been failure after failure. Lecanemab, another amyloid clearance molecule, is now licensed in the US. You know, these are drugs for countries with a lot of money and a lot of specialised scanners, these positron emission tomography scanners, because you have to have a map of amyloid in your brain, and very few Alzheimer's patients anywhere get these. So that is a hurdle. Lecanemab, or as I said, already licensed in the US, costs about £21,000, more than $26,000 per patient per year. That cost will be a hurdle. But the reason why charities are really excited is because it's a start and better drugs will come.
Fergus Walsh. 2 million people are expected to watch the Women's World Cup, which will be held in New Zealand and Australia over the next month, with the opening match on Thursday. And with perfect timing, the Australian team have said there should be equal prize money for the women's and the men's game. There's certainly been a huge increase in audiences and investment for the women's game. Our reporter Sam Fenwick spoke about this to the former footballer Moya Dodd.
Women's football has been slow to attract the dollars it deserves because of these default assumptions that nobody wants to watch.
Moya Dodd is a former vice-captain of Australia's women's football team, the Matildas. She played in FIFA's first ever women's tournament in 1988. She was also a member of the FIFA Council, where she developed FIFA's gender reforms, which were passed in 2016.
The game can't escape its own history. I mean, there's a century of underinvestment, bans, neglect, institutional indifference, and the game that we see now has as its starting point the legacy that that has left us. Even when those formal bans were lifted, the level of priority that the women's game was given did not enable it to accelerate as it should have.
DAZNs is the only streaming service to show the Women's Champions League. It partnered with YouTube to make the games available to watch for free. DAZN have now done a deal with UEFA, and next season the streaming platform will be the only place where you can watch every match of the UEFA Champions League live, although fans will have to pay for some matches. DAZN's biggest market is Germany, so I asked Alicia Machia, the company's CEO for Germany, Switzerland and Austria, to talk me through their viewing figures.
This is our second big year. In the first year, we get started, and I think that there were, 600,000 subscribers to your YouTube channel. So I think that's big numbers there from zero.
The value of club sponsorship is set to increase sixfold. By 2033, UEFA predict it'll be worth nearly €300 million. Rachel Howard represented New Zealand. She was a goalkeeper and was selected to play in the 2007 FIFA Women's World Cup. Rachel was one of only three members of the squad not to get any playing time in the tournament. She says the game has progressed dramatically since she was playing.
For me, the World Cup being hosted in Australia and New Zealand is my home country. It's a particularly proud moment for us. There's a turning point at each of these milestones because it's something new that's building on the next one.
Rachel now works for Adidas, where she's the Vice President of Emerging Markets. The global sportswear brand has supported women's football since the 1991 World Cup in China, when it provided official balls for the tournament. Since then, it's steadily increased its focus on women's football. It's one of the main sponsors of the UEFA Champions League and this year's World Cup.
From a brand perspective, that's exciting because of the visibility. And the visibility is the most important part. When the visibility is there, players are seen by the next generation of girls who want to play football. And for us as Adidas, that's a critical part of why we're partnering and keen to be able to drive the women's football game forward.
Rachel Howard, former player with the New Zealand football team, ending that report by Sam Fenwick. It must have seemed like a good idea at the time. Last April, the Australian sailor Tim Shaddock set off from Mexico, aiming to sail his boat to the tropical islands of French Polynesia in the Pacific. On board with him, his dog, Bella. But then, things went badly wrong, as our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, explained to me.
Tim Shaddock, he set off from Mexico, as you said, for French Polynesia with his dog, Bella. A couple of weeks into the journey, though, there was a storm which knocked out the electronics and the communication devices, so he couldn't navigate, couldn't contact the rest of the world. So basically, they were drifting at sea for a couple of months, surviving just on rainwater and fish, which they'd... Fortunately, the yachtsman had managed to take his fishing gear, so they caught some fish. So that's what they survived on, sheltering from the sun. Eventually, though, they were picked up by a Mexican tuna trawler, which had spotted them. There's a helicopter on this trawler. It'd gone out looking for tuna and spotted the yacht drifting at sea and picked up Mr. Shaddock. And when he got on board, this is the message that he had to give.
Been through a very difficult ordeal at sea, and I'm just needing rest and good food because I've been alone at sea a long time.
Alone at sea a long time, and you see some of the photographs of Mr. Shaddock when he got on board that boat. Before he set off, he was looking lean and had a little bit of muscle on him, and he was cleanly shaven. But on the photos afterwards, you see him, he's got dishevelled hair, long beard, all matted. It looked a little bit, or not dissimilar to Tom Hanks in the film Castaway, which transformed his appearance. Now he's kind of getting medical support on board this trawler. He's on his way back to Mexico. Medical team on the trawler say he's doing well, his vital signs are okay, and he looks to be recovering. The dog, Bella, as well, looks to be doing fine too. So it's a happy ending to what could have been a very, very terrible story.
Michael Bristow. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.